I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Griffin Campbell is the only person criminally convicted for his role in the 2013 Center City, Philadelphia building collapse that killed seven. Now the local NAACP and Campbell's attorney are calling on the Philadelphia District Attorney to look into cutting his 15 to 30-year-long sentence. NAACP President Rodney Muhammad says many involved in the project were never charged, even though they were found liable in a civil trial that was settled for $227 million.
We're calling not only on District Attorney Seth Williams to have a full review of the conviction review unit on this case to look at a recommendation for the reduction of sentence, or to exonerate Griffin Campbell altogether because of this great miscarriage of justice.
Muhammad is calling for Campbell to be exonerated, but is not asking the DA to prosecute those he believes bear most responsibility for the deadly collapse. The building owner, Richard Basciano, and the Salvation Army were both found liable in the civil suit. Many killed by the collapse were inside a Salvation Army thrift store when the demolition of a building next door went horribly wrong. Prosecutors in New Jersey will not have to present witnesses at detention hearings for criminal suspects. The court ruling is a loss for defense attorneys. They say questioning witnesses allows defendants to push back on charges lodged against them. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, it's part of the Garden State's bail overhaul that began January 1st.
Detention hearings occur within days after a suspect is arrested. It's where a judge decides whether the defendant should stay in jail or be released until trial. Criminal defense advocates say prosecutors should have to call witnesses at these hearings so defense attorneys can question them and have a better chance of keeping their client out of jail. For example, maybe they ask the arresting officer if her vision was impaired when she says she saw the defendant commit the crime. Right now, defendants have to wait until trial for that kind of questioning, and in the meantime, they could be sitting in jail on shaky evidence. Today, a New Jersey appeals court said police reports and other charging documents are enough evidence for a detention hearing. The decision came in response to the case of a man who was picked up with a gun in Camden in January. Alexander Shalom with the New Jersey ACLU is disappointed with how the justices ruled.
Not only did they say in general one could call no witnesses, they said that in this case where all the affidavit said was the defendant was arrested with a gun, that would be enough. And if that's enough, really anything is enough.
Prosecutors are still allowed to call witnesses at these hearings. They just don't have to. In a statement, Attorney General Christopher Perino said, quote, "The court has struck the right balance to maintain both defendants' rights and the timely but fair judicial determinations required under the new laws." From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
This next story focuses on sexual abuse and may not be appropriate for all listeners. Two women who were sexually abused by a suspected serial pedophile in Bucks County spoke out today. The sisters were just 4 and 7 years old when their babysitter, William Charles Thomas, allegedly began molesting them. They say the abuse went on for years, and now in their 20s, they say they hope by telling their story, they'll give courage to other possible victims to proceed.
But I feel as though not enough people come forward and speak up in situations like these, and that is what makes it possible for these horrible predators to get away with these situations for so long. I want women all over the world to find courage, like I did, to speak up, to get the justice they deserve, and to put predators like William away in prison where they belong.
While they are speaking out and even being photographed, they're not disclosing their names to the media or the public. Thomas was living and working as a handyman in a Morrisville trailer park when police arrested him last month. They suspect he raped many children over 40 years. Detectives found physical evidence, including hundreds of images of child pornography in his mobile home. Police say Thomas documented his alleged abuse in sexually explicit writings that detectives found on the walls of his home and shed. The older sister says the alleged abuse has had a profound effect on her.
Things like this mess a person up for their whole lives. wondering what was wrong with you, why you could seclude yourself from the world, why you could never get the right amount of affection to the people who try to love you, why you can never let anyone in, and why you can't find some reason to love yourself. You blame yourself for being the outcast, the weird one of the things that you've been put through. But today, I will no longer feel that way, that this is not my fault, because I wasn't even old enough to understand. I was being taken advantage of by a grown adult child molester.
Thomas remains in jail on $900,000 bail. He faces a preliminary hearing March 28th. President Donald Trump's first address to a joint session of Congress last night included a familiar refrain.
We have undertaken a historic effort to massively reduce job-crushing regulations, creating a deregulation task force inside of every government agency. And we're imposing a new rule which mandates that for every one new regulation, two old regulations must be eliminated.
Joining me to look at potential environmental implications is State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips. Susan, the president went on to describe what some are calling a two-for-one deal.
So far, Dave, two environmental regulations have been ditched.
Let's review them.
One has to do with stream protection and coal mines. The stream protection rule was aimed at keeping coal mining waste out of streams. And this was directed mostly at the mountaintop removal. It's a type of mining that's common in central Appalachia, and it ended up burying more than 1,000 miles of streams. And so what the rule said was it put limits on, you know, what kind of coal mining waste would end up in these streams. And so the Republicans and Trump got rid of that. Okay, so that was number one, the stream protection rule. Number two was recently this week was what was called the Waters of the U.S. rule. And this was an attempt by the EPA under the Obama administration to get rid of a lot of confusion over what small streams or smaller isolated wetlands would deserve protection from pollution.
Was it defining what qualifies as a small stream?
Yes, exactly. It defined what qualified as a small stream, but business interests like builders, farmers, and golf course owners like Donald Trump didn't like it. What they said was this went too far. So Trump scrapped that rule, and now the EPA has to go back to the drawing board and come up with a different rule, and they were basically instructed to make that rule less strict.
The president also used last night's speech to take aim once again at regulations that he says threatens the viability of those in the trade.
In the coal industry specifically, that's right. And here's the thing, Dave, that coal producers are really competing with cheap natural gas. And they like to say that the environmental rules is what killed the coal industry. But really, it was market forces. You know, coal consumption has been trending down for years in this country. Coal producers borrowed assuming that there was going to be an increase in demand from overseas that didn't materialize. So now they're faced with large debts. And it's not just natural gas. Coal is also competing now with wind and solar power, which once the windmills are up and the solar panels are in place, it actually is cheaper to produce that energy than it is to produce coal energy.
So we are years out from that happening on a large basis. So let's look at natural gas. And the president contends that there will be a surge in jobs in that industry, as evidenced by him authorizing the Keystone and Dakota Access pipelines.
We have cleared the way for the construction of the Keystone and Dakota Access pipelines, thereby creating tens of thousands of jobs.
So there is this strange relationship between coal and natural gas. He thinks, you know, that he's going to bring both of them back, but there's just so much need for energy, and if natural gas is cheaper, that's what the power plants are going to burn. They're not going to burn coal that's more expensive. So he's saying that he's going to increase coal jobs, but then he's also saying, okay, we're going to be building these new natural gas pipelines across the country, which will also be creating jobs.
Thanks, Susan.
You're welcome.
State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips on NewsWorks Tonight. The painting Christina's World is probably the most famous artwork by one of America's best-known artists, Andrew Wyeth. The Chads Ford native painted it in 1948 while staying in Maine. It depicts a woman lying on a hill covered in tall grass looking up at a clapboard house. The figure in the painting is Anna Christina Olson, a woman that Andrew Wyeth was fascinated by and painted often. She's now the subject of a new novel called A Piece of the World by Christina Baker Klein. WHYY's arts and culture reporter Peter Crimmins spoke with Klein about the life of Christina Olson.
One of the things that about Andrew Wyeth and his paintings is that he buries stories in his work, sometimes literally, like under layers of tempura paint, there are secrets buried there that the casual observer might not pick up on. And in the case of Christina's World, if you know that the woman in the painting can't walk, ratchets up the drama of the painting. It's this wrenching narrative, a lot of pathos. And so I'm wondering if part of the drama that Andrew Wyeth is creating in the painting is what drove you to want to write a story about Christina Olson.
Oh, absolutely. That's sort of the starting point. So the novel, A Piece of the World, is ostensibly the story of the relationship between Andrew Wyeth and Christina Olson. But a lot of the story is actually about her past. It's about all the elements in her past that led to that painting. And one of the things that I love about her real life story is that she's descended from the chief magistrate of the Salem witch trials, John Hathorne. He is the only one of the three judges who never recanted. He was a notorious, terrible person. He persecuted Quakers. He ambushed and tricked and murdered Native Americans. He then put nearly 2 dozen women to death and never had any problem with it at all. And in fact, on the scaffold, one of those accused witches put a curse on the family of John Hathorne forevermore into the future. And I think that family, Christina Olson's family, took it very much to heart. Her grandmother, Tryphena, kept the door open between the shed and the kitchen for the witches to come and go. And they lived with this idea of ghosts and witches. So there's lots in my novel that I didn't have to even make up.
The painting tells a certain story about Christina. And it's a story of a woman who her world is very small. I mean, her world is this plot of land in Maine. And so I wonder what you saw in that you could expand to a novel.
There were so many factors. I'll give you a couple. One, I grew up an hour and a half from there. My grandmother, Christina, I'm the third Christina, my mother, my grandmother. My grandmother, Christina, was born within a few years of Christina Olson and grew up very similarly in a rural farmhouse, a white clapboard house, had a degenerative disease as a child, a polio-like illness, took care of her family as Christina Olson did. I was really interested in how people got by and the emotional tools they needed to survive hard times. But there's one other thing, which I don't actually normally talk about, but I'll mention, which is that I had just come through, I had breast cancer. It was really bad, actually. I had a bad form. I'm fine now, apparently. But it was a rough year, a year in which my mother died and I had this really terrible I was very medicalized at one point. I was in the hospital for a week and had a death scare. I mean, it was bad. But I became acutely aware of my own mortality and vulnerability, and I found a way in this character to sort of – she was such a strong, persevering spirit. I really admired that. I also admired that she lived with this – disease that was never diagnosed that got worse over time, but with such sort of pride and stubborn strength.
The way you write her, write Christina, whenever someone suggests that perhaps you can get better, perhaps there's a treatment or a doctor, she bristles.
Yeah.
And she says no, almost like she doesn't understand why anyone would want to make things differently.
There's something about the way Christina was a stoic about her illness. I mean, The truth is, people who live with what she had, which is called Charcot-Marie-Tooth, there is no cure now. Today, there is not. And so the fact that she kept avoiding going to doctors who didn't know what they were doing and kept misdiagnosing her and had no treatment for her. And
they could probably make it worse.
They could only make it worse. And in fact, her father lost their family fortune by listening to a quack, which is in my novel as well. He, too, had a degenerative illness, which they called arthritis, and I believe now it was CMT, the same thing, because it's hereditary. It's often passed from a father to a daughter. But I also kind of admire her impatience with people who were made uncomfortable by it. Mm-hmm. She just lived with it. I mean, her father, there's a line in the book that I can't quite remember, but her father was in a wheelchair. He saw it as a safe haven, and she saw it as a prison, the wheelchair. So she didn't use one, which meant that she pulled herself around, which I think some people were uncomfortable with, you might imagine, and Wyeth thought was marvelous.
I'm speaking with Christina Baker Klein. Her new novel is A Piece of the World. It's about Anna Christina Olsen, the subject of Andrew Wyeth's most famous painting, Christina's World. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Musician and composer Monette Sudler will hold her 8th annual Philadelphia Guitar Summit Saturday night at Montgomery County Community College. The event celebrates diverse approaches to the instrument, though it focuses on her first love, jazz. WHYY's Alex Lewis introduces us to the Germantown resident, often referred to as Philadelphia's First Lady of Guitar.
Monette Sudler says the guitar feels less like an instrument and more like a part of her body.
Because now, at this point in my life, you know, when I pick it up, it's just, it just feels natural. I'm supposed to hold it, and it's really just an extension of myself now. So whatever I'm trying to convey, excitement or, you know, love or blues, you know, happy times or gratefulness, I believe I convey that.
Sudler started on the piano, but when she picked up the guitar at 15 years old, she never looked back. Primarily a jazz player, she's also dabbled in the avant-garde and funk. In her 40-plus year career, she's performed around the world and with jazz legends like Grover Washington and Reggie Workman. And she has numerous releases to her name, some of which are on the prestigious label Steeplechase Records. But although she's enjoyed a prolific and successful life as a musician, there's a stigma that lingers.
This guy, he sat with me at the Clef Club, and he says to me, you know, we introduced ourselves, and I said, you know, a jazz guitarist. He sat back, and he looked at me and said, well, you don't look like a jazz guitarist. And I'm like, okay, what does that look like? You know what I mean? So people always kind of say little stupid things like that.
Especially when she was coming up in the jazz scene in the late 70s and 80s, Sudler says there was a hesitance about hiring a woman in a band, that they would cause trouble or not carry their weight. She saw this as an opportunity to strike out on her own.
When I get up in the morning, I don't think, you know, I'm a female guitarist, and, you know, how is the world going to look at me? Only thing I can do as a musician is to do my best, be true to myself, and let everybody else be where they are, you know? So sometimes you just have to make your own way in the scheme of things. And I feel like I've done that to the best of my ability at this point.
On a snowy winter evening, Sudler played a gig with old friends from the Philadelphia scene at South, a spacious New Orleans-inspired jazz club on North Broad Street. Gerald Beasley, a well-respected bassist, says Monette hired him for his very first gig.
The very first person to give me a chance to play in her band, so I always thank her for that. I think she has an elegance about the way she plays. Every note is a gem, and her sound is just crystal clear and beautiful.
Thaddeus Govan, sitting at a table near the front of the stage, had been a huge fan of Sudler's for years, before discovering they both grew up in Germantown. He started taking lessons from his hero in 1985.
Monette has a rich, thick, warm, round sound, which is unusual in today's world. And it's all about her artistry, her flavor, her phrasing. Thank you.
Sudler had a health scare in 2013, pulmonary fibrosis, which weakened her immune system and her voice. But her fans and friends across Philadelphia and in the jazz community came to her aid. They organized a benefit concert and raised enough money for her to receive the double lung transplant that saved her life.
I just think it's a miracle, almost a total blessing. Music is a healing force. It just really is. And for me, it calms my spirit, you know, it gives me hope.
After recovering from her surgery, Sudler has been as prolific as ever, recording, composing music for the theater, and she continues to curate her annual Philadelphia Guitar Summit that celebrates different approaches to the guitar.
Mostly, I try to keep it diverse and have people that are performing that are, like, really different. I've just had a lot of really wonderful people perform, and they all really get a kick out of hearing the other musicians and interacting and just learning about their style of music.
The walls of Sudler's apartment in Germantown are covered with photos of her musical heroes, many who are also her peers, evidence of the self-determination that's driven her ever since being turned down for gigs earlier in her career. Now she feels more inspired than ever.
Can't lie about music, and so the things that you experience will automatically, you know, come out in your music in some way.
For WHYY, I'm Alex Lewis.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.